This evening, we're going to talk about a historical Holden Village. The discussion is going to last 45 or 50 minutes. We will stop at any time that you wish to talk about any topic, or if a question comes to your mind about something that we say, feel free to interrupt us, and we'll embark upon your topic. First, I would like to introduce Bertha Pearson. Bertha is 81 years young. Bertha was the first cook at Holden Village. She cooked in 1961, 62, and 63. If any of you have been to the Mine Museum, you have seen an article of her trade. There is a stove, wood stove up there, marked Bertha, and you are looking at the individual that stove was named after. That was her first stove that she cooked on at Holden Village. On my right is my wife, Loretta. I'm sorry, I've forgotten her age. Loretta has been dubbed the Cookie Lady of Holden Village. For 20 years, in each of those years at Christmas time, she home-baked and delivered up to 15,000 cookies, over 650 pounds of candy, and over 125 fruit and traditional cakes to Holden Village for the enjoyment of the staff and guests. Wow. My name is Howard Gilling, and I'm 27 years old.
Yes, you are.
Bertha is going to help us discuss the 1961 through the 1963 era from a cook's perspective. She tells me that she's not too great on delivering presentations, and she's given me a long list of things here that she says you have free access to relay to you people, and if they're of interest to you, like I've mentioned before, she's more than willing to elaborate on them and attempt to answer any additional questions. Bertha first came up to Holden Village in May of 1961. She left in October of that year. She came back in May of 62 and 63, and she left in November of those 2 years. The period that she was here at the village just as the cook, and there were no either staff volunteer or cleanup volunteer people around here, formerly known as, or I guess now known as, forerunners. She was here with Reuben Thompson. Reuben Thompson was a man that was the caretaker of the village on a year-round basis. And many times Reuben was out of the village, and Bertha was here alone. She has relayed to me some of those experiences. I think one of the more notable ones was that as she would often be baking her bread on this stove out in back of Chalet 1 in 1961 and early 62, it was not unusual for deer to come up to her and actually get close enough to occasionally nudge her. One of the first obstacles that Bertha said she had to overcome, and she laid awake several nights thinking about this, was that when they finally brought her a stove that she could start to ply her trade on, she found out that the wall between, this was a wood burning stove, the wall between the firebox and the oven had rusted and or been burned out, so that the heat and coals directly in the firebox were visible from within the oven. So she had to try and figure out, what am I going to do about this? I can't bake and cook this way. So she finally came up with the idea of lining that wall with some aluminum foil, which she did, and it worked. And then she proceeded to bake her bread and all the other necessary things in the oven, as well as cook on top of the stove. In 1961, when she came the 1st of May, of course, she was here for 3 or 4 weeks by herself. as far as the staff, volunteer along with Reuben. Then the first group of forerunners came. And she had some difficult problems to overcome. One of the big problems that she first encountered was the fact that, of course, there was no electricity, and therefore there was not the customary refrigeration equipment available. So she had some of the gentlemen put in one of these large, what we would call big 30-gallon garbage cans, and anchored it in one of the creeks, and that was her refrigerator. She would put the food in there that she wished to cool down. Her stove, as I mentioned, was over in back of Chalet 1. She did all of her cooking there. She baked her bread there.
Inside of Chalet 1 was the first stove, and it had only three legs.
Yes, and we have a story later on about that three-legged stove. She ordered her supplies once a week, and the order was sent out by Gil Berg, and then it came up again. At that time, they had a barge that came up just like it does now, one day a week on Thursday. And that's when she got her supplies, and if they missed the barge or they, for some reason, didn't get filled, then she just didn't get them. There was no way of making a contact to get the food supplies. Her help was all volunteer. It was a rotational type thing. In those days, everybody was a volunteer. Everybody helped her occasionally with cooking. Everybody washed dishes on a turnover basis, as well as doing the regular work in the village that they came to do. Initially, there was no hot water. And all the water that was hot was heated on top of her stove. Her day started between 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning and ended between 10 to 11 at night. She recalls one incident that she thought was humorous. I'm sure some people were a little skeptical about it. One morning, she obviously was quite tired, and she overslept. And at that time, she was living in one of the chalets up at the top of the circle, top of the hill, and she was always down in front of her stove no later than 5 o'clock. Well, one morning, it was 6 o'clock, and she wasn't there. And one of the young girls that were here, that was here on staff, thought she'd better go up and check on Bertha. She was very afraid what she was going to find. And she got up to Bertha's bedroom, and she saw this lady laying in bed, and she was sure she was dead. And she finally got up enough nerve to go and touch her, and sure enough, she was alive. When Bertha first came to Holden in May of 61, I think it's for some of the people, Carol, I think, included, and Elmer, and some of you other, that I don't know whether Bill was up here that early, Bill Dirks or not, but
Karen was here in 62 as an unfolder.
All right. So
she's earlier than anybody here, I think.
Okay, well, you people certainly recognize that it's a little incomprehensible to the rest of us, the mess that this village was in. I heard of a lot of it in my relationship with the Seattle King County Lutheran Council, because we were trying to come up with funds to foot the bills for all this. But it was a mess, and we kept hearing this. And one of the things that Bertha has relayed to us is that I've always wondered, well, why didn't they first clean out the dining hall and move in there? Because food is such a paramount significance when you're in a place like this and you're working hard. But she said the tables were all in the dining room, but when the people last left the village, they had left the food on the tables and the plates full, and they just up and left. And for 4 years, this food had been drying, so obviously it was pretty well caked on. And finally they got around to deciding that they were going to have to clean all these pots, pans, utensils. So they got one of these big tubs that were around here, filled it with water, put it on an outside fireplace, and boiled the water. And one by one, they ran through in cycles these pots, pans, utensils. It took hours to even loosen up a lot of these things, to soak it loose and clean up these utensils and plates. Foodstuffs. Bertha says she always tried to keep plenty of hamburger on hand. She felt she could make meatballs, hamburgers, meatloaf with that. And of course, with no refrigeration, it was a problem with what she could have up here in the way of fresh foods. They occasionally had beef roasts that they would cook, canned ham, chicken, and some fish. They would order fresh vegetables and fresh fruits on a weekly basis. Other regulars included pancakes, French toast, eggs, bacon, and potato salad. When they cooked the food over in back of Chalet 1, and then they set up tables in the village center, the gym, and they served the food in there. They would carry it over and serve it there. In late 1962, she was promoted in importance and she received a second stove. She now had two stoves. And they were set up in the cookhouse. And the cookhouse was located immediately behind where the present kitchen is. And it is now the sauna. In late 1962, she was moved into the kitchen where the present site is now, and in the remainder of 62 and in the year 63 and ever since then, of course, that has been the kitchen, other than for the winters when they have moved down here in Coronia the past few years. At one time, Bertha was cooking over on the stove behind Chalet 1 that first year, and at that time, they had to use all of the things that were left over from the mining days. And, of course, they thought in terms of quantity then, because they were cooking for several hundred people. But here comes along Bertha and the forerunners, and there were not that many of them, but they still had to use these pots, pans, etc. And she had a large pot that covered the whole top of her stove that
inside.
And she was cooking a pot of stew on the stove. And at the same time, out in front of Chalet 1 on the street, Gil Berg was holding a fire instruction drill. And this stove, as Bertha has mentioned before, only had three legs on it, and the fourth corner had been propped up by a waste paper basket that had been turned upside down. And as she was working in the kitchen, as she went over to look at her stew and probably stir it, tend to it, see how it was doing, and all of a sudden she noticed that pot was beginning to tilt and began to slide off the top of the stove. And her reflex was, of course, to grab the pot of stew, and she realized the third leg, the second leg, if you would please, was beginning to collapse on the stove. So it really only had two legs. So she proceeded to scream, at which time the fire crew came running into the house and bailed her out and pushed some wood blocks under the stove and propped up her stove so she wouldn't lose her stew. To Bertha, some of the more complicating circumstances she had to put up with were the fact that she had no electricity, therefore she had no relatively modern refrigeration. It was a very common practice that Gil Berg or somebody would leave the village to go down and meet the boat, and they would anticipate five or six people coming, and they'd come back with the truck, and there would be anywhere from 20 to 30 people on the back of the truck. And she had to ad lib to come up with food to feed these people. Probably one of the more difficult situations that she confronted was in the early fall of 1962, when they had their first pastor's conference up here at the village, and they still had no running water, no hot water inside. They were still basically cooking outside. There was still a lot of complicating factors. And one of the arrangements that had been made with this group of pastors, there was to be approximately 60 to 80 of them coming with their wives. The arrangement was that they were to bring their own food. And somewhere along the line,
they were supposed to bring the food from town.
Yes. And somewhere along the line, this communication broke down and the transportation didn't work out. And these people arrived, 60 to 80 of them, with no food. And I asked Bertha, well, what did you do? And she said, well, I went into the storage room and I got out several cans of ham and I ground up the ham, and we had a lot of ham loaf that week.
Well, we were supposed to have chicken. That's what they were supposed to be bringing. This chicken and different breakfast foods, you know, and different things.
And there was nothing.
Didn't come to, I forgot what day it came. 25 years is a long time to remember.
Well, I can attest to the fact that our pastor at that time, Bob Reakey, who was Vern, you know, many of you know Vern Reakey's brother, and also Pastor Bob at that time was president of LBI. He was the one that signed the property from LBI over to Holden Village. He came back from that conference, and I walked up to him one Sunday morning and asked him how he enjoyed Holden Village, because that was his first experience up here. And I've never seen such a negative response from him in my life. All he could talk about were mosquitoes and flies and bugs and cold water, limited food. It was I don't think he came back, I think it was about 1978 or so before he came back.
We heard a lot of complaints about the cool water.
Yeah. In 1962, late summer, I believe it was, the first electricity was made available to the village when two diesel generators that are now the standby generators down by the bridge were installed. And then they had electricity, at least a limited amount of it during the day. I think they turned the generators off at 10 o'clock at night.
That's
right.
It
was 10.
Something like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. Let me just sort of take a break there, and Loretta and I will make some comments in a few minutes. But are there any questions, comments you would like to direct at Bertha regarding her experiences those first few years?
How did you happen to get this wonderful job in the first place?
Well, my children were growing and away, so I would be all alone. And they came and asked me if I would like to go up here. So that is how, Gilberg and Pastor Stein were the ones that encouraged me. And so I came up on Sunday. I think one weekend we came up. That was the first I ever came up. And it was still snow before I came up to stay. I don't know, whatever.
Had you been a cook, Bertha? Had you been a cook for large groups of people? You just a housewife?
But I had taken cooking in for groups for school. Mm-hmm. So I worked at school. So.
Now, had your daughter met Pastor Stein's son at that time?
Yeah, but they were married in 63.
In 63, all right. That was one connection.
Yeah.
Well, they must have known you were an adventuresome person to ask you to come way up here.
I don't know.
She doesn't like the alternative, I think is what she's saying.
Howard, Pastor Stein was president of Lutheran Bible Institute at the time.
That's
yes,
correct.
Yes, he was.
For
that's
many correct.
Years.
Yes. Yes. And Gil Berg was on the board of right. LBI.
I want to know if Bertha still has the applesauce, the special applesauce prune cake recipe. I remember asking you that right as I was leaving, and I think it was 62.
And you haven't got it yet?
Good morning, Gil. Patience, patience.
It was a great cake, but it was based on having a pan, enough stuff there for 50 or 60 people. And so she was going to cut it down. And it was terrific, but it was, I never forget that cake. That was great cake.
Well, just the other day, I found my cookbook that I used up here. A lot of the recipes, that were enlarged 3-4 times. And I was thinking about that.
Yeah. So she was probably dangling a carrot in front of you, Carol, and she thought if she waited long enough, she'd get you to come back almost every year looking for that recipe.
Yeah, probably.
Anything else for Bertha's era?
Bertha, how many people were here when they weren't in 61 and 62 when they weren't having like the Forerunners or Stehekin? How many people were you cooking for most of the time?
Well, groups kept coming in, I to see. Work. But not as many, because they were around 30, the Forerunners were around 30. And the others were maybe 12 or so. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have as many then. Mm-hmm. But of course they always helped,
Sure.
I didn't do any all of it alone as long as anyone was here. And a lot of times there would come maybe a couple and they would help. Mm-hmm. Cutting wood was the biggest thing. Yeah. To keep wood in that wood burning stove.
Who led classes or anything they had? Was it always the people who came up?
Well, Bergstrand came up with that. And I was trying to remember that, but I cannot remember who led the
Dr. Laris was from PLU was one of them that came up.
Yeah, he was here.
Actually.
Oh yeah, that group from PLU. They were
they had field trips up there. Natural field trips at the same time they were I don't know whether it was that early, it might have been about 62, 63 when that started.
Mm-hmm. In the second group, Dr. Bergstrand led the group while he was writing his book on John the Baptist behind one of those chalets. And we had evening devotions with Bergstrand.
Yes.
We were the unfolders. And we unfolded the Martin Luther Trail, which I understand is now closed down. And the tailings out there we named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I guess that tradition hasn't continued out either.
Yeah. One tradition that has continued, we were fortunate enough to be able to go up and get the oral tradition from Bertha. And she was telling me about their substitute lefse. You want to tell them about that, Bertha? Your answer to lefse?
Oh, yeah. Some girls were came in and they wanted the snack, you know, between lunch and breakfast. So they said, oh, but I wish I had some lefse. And I had some leftover pancakes left. So I said, well, put some butter and brown sugar or sugar or something and roll them up just and pretend they are lefse.
So we still have that today? Coffee break.
It probably beat some of the lefse we paid over the years.
Well, Bertha, I don't know how everybody else feels, but I've always felt a great deal of gratitude for people like you, and we really appreciate those early years, the things that you did for us, because we certainly are rewarded now for that time that you spent here. Thank you very much. Loretta and I came to Holden Village as a family in the summer of 1966. We brought our son with us, who at that time was age 4, and our daughter, who was 7. I had been associated with Holden Village from the beginning through the Seattle King County Lutheran Council. I was supposed to come up with the first group, but I chickened out. I don't think I chickened out, but who knows what what was going on at that time. But I heard a lot of reports from the people that came back from Holden at that time of the problems that were here. I think that was the paramount thing that you discussed about Holden Village the first year or two, were the problems. And they all had a big fat dollar sign in front of them, and there was no money in the treasury, so to speak. So the people that were here that stepped out in faith, and it was a step out in faith, because by taking over this property, we signed for the liability that was here. And if we had not made it, we would have had to restore it to its natural state. Tear down all these buildings, remove the foundations, replant, reforest. That's an expensive process. And by signing for it, that's what we signed for. And everything was negative, like I say. So it was a step in faith. Our first summer here was a very gratifying summer. We were exposed to several things that began to linger on as tradition at Holden. I'm going to say some things. I'm not very good at talking. My wife is going to have to do most of it. We were exposed initially to the auction process, and that was the great fundraising process at Holden. Everything was auctioned. There was a monetary purpose to so many things, but there was so much fun about it that you couldn't help but get wrapped up in it. And I remember that first year of 66 was the first year that the village bought one of the small red snow cats. And they auctioned off the little miniature snow cats, you know, that the kids play with, the little Tonka toys or whatever they are. And you could buy one of those for $100. And Werner sold them, and he still didn't have them in stock. he gave you a rain check, and when he got them, he'd send them to you.
We still have ours.
Yeah, that's quite an experience. We want to spend a little more time on the Christmas side, the winter side of Holden Village. Loretta and I were the first guests that came to Holden Village at Christmas time. We came in the Christmas season of 1966. They did not allow children at the village that year, and Loretta and I came up, and there were 5 other people. There were 7 of us all together, and we lived over in Chalet 1. Judy and Werner Jansen had been married that September, and they were still honeymooners. We stayed until the day before Christmas, and then went home, of course, to be with our children. We subsequently came up for the next 19 Christmases and spent them here at Holden.
That first Christmas, Judy and I did the cooking. She was a new bride, she was only 19. I was older, and I'm from a family
not much though,
of 10 children. So cooking for more people was a little bit more common to me, but it was great. We did the cooking and the fellows did the dishes. And that was fun. And we set up a Christmas tree and we didn't have any decorations, there were none. We strung popcorn and made all of our own decorations.
Paper chains. Yeah. I think we've all done that. Maybe some of the younger people have, but I think most of the people have done those things. We used to sit around over there in the living room of Chalet 1. Of course, that was before it was remodeled. And we'd stay up until about 10:30, a quarter 11 at night, during all these Christmas decorations, just talking. There were seven of us, Loretta and I, Judy and Werner, Terry Saturn, many of you may know.
The dancing servant.
Yes.
Sculptor.
A very talented young man. The harpsichord, where is it? Is it in here? Terry made that harpsichord from scratch. And many, many other things around the village, sculpturing, metal sculpturing. Joe Walmer, who is no longer with us, was he here that year? Mm-hmm. Yes, Joe Walmer was here, maintenance man, and a Harvey Matheson from Montana. One of the things I remember about that winter was one evening that week that we were here. Of course, this was my wife and I grew up in Eastern Washington, and then we transplanted over to Seattle, and we just love the snow. We have always enjoyed going to where it's cold and or a lot of snow. And Joe Walmer always had to have a smoke before he retired in the evening. And one evening he stepped out on the front porch and was starting to light up his cigarette. And as he was lighting his cigarette, a sudden wind came up and blew out the match. And when he went out, it had been perfectly calm. And he went ahead and lit up his cigarette and smoked it and put it out and came back in. And he was relaying this to us just as an afterthought. Gee, that was funny that I was standing out there and it was so calm, and all of a sudden this wind came up and blew out my match and I had to relight my cigarette. And we didn't think too much of it, and the evening went on, and pretty soon Terry Saturn thought that before we retired in the evening, somebody always had to go up and check the hydro. And it was Terry's night to check the hydro, so he went out, and we kept the little snowmobile that we called Gretchen, and he was started up and was going up the road, and he was gone the normal time, and he came back, and he was all excited. And he said, Joe, I know why your cigarette was blown out now. And he said, well, why? And he said, well, as I went up the road, just the small finger of an avalanche came down through the ravine right up here above the animal hutch, if you know where I'm talking of, up and back of the hospital and to the northwest there. And that wasn't the big avalanche that came down and took out the garage and whatnot, but it was an avalanche, and the wind that came suddenly out of that avalanche was what blew out Joe's match on the front porch of Chalet 1. In 1967, we came back, and they allowed children in the village, so we brought our two children. They were the only children, the first two children here. And that year, there were 13 of us here at the village. And Judy and Werner and Judy's mother, Nadine, were living up in Chalet 14. And the rest of us lived in Chalet 1. And I think some of the people lived downstairs. Not downstairs. I'm not sure now. I thought I was going to say in Cornea, but Cornea wasn't done yet. I'm not sure now where they lived. The people that were here, Nadine, Werner, and Judy, and Loretta, and myself, and Sandy, and James, Terry Saturn, Jim, I don't remember his name. All I remember is that he was a graduate from Lewis and Clark High School in Spokane, and he was here helping Terry with maintenance. Jim. Yes, yes, thank you, yes. And Horty and Mary Christman. Most of you may remember Horty and Mary. One of the things that happened that year that our son, who at that time was 5 years old, will never forget. And bear in mind now, all of us probably in here have had children and raised them. Our children came to the village then at the age of 8 and 5, and they knew no other Christmas than Holden for the next 18 years. So it was quite an experience for them, because our son still does not know how to Christmas shop. I think the most degrading thing for him is to have to stand in line to buy a gift for somebody. He just can't understand this, because he's never had to do it.
Our Christmas gifts in those years was coming to Holden.
We
did not exchange Christmas gifts.
No. If we did, it was a very small token gift. I think that's one of the really delightful things about the Christmas Holden experience, is to really find a different meaning of Christmas that we all at some time or another have thought about, but maybe have not been exposed to. It's a very, very interesting and cherished experience. I was going to tell you the experience of our son James, who was 5 at that time, and we had been very practical, we thought, in raising our children. We tried to show them all the normal joys and thrills and whatnot of growing up, and we talked about Santa Claus and whatnot, but we had just gotten to that point where we thought that we should at least begin to level with our children about Santa Claus. And they really hadn't given up, but yet they were hearing some dialogue from Mom and Dad that maybe Santa Claus wasn't real, and they didn't know quite what to think. Well, in those days, Holden always had a Santa Claus, and at that time we had an old Santa Claus suit that had been worn in the mining days that we found up here, with the old real sheepskin on and whatnot. And Horty Christman dressed up as Santa Claus that year, and I can still see him coming down the hallway upstairs, Koinonia, shouting, "Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas!" And he hung out over that railing, and our son was sitting down here, and his eyes got as big as saucers. He couldn't believe what he was seeing. This was Santa Claus, and it was at Holden. I don't think we convinced him for the next 15 years that there wasn't Santa Claus. The modes of transportation that we had in coming to Holden Village, particularly at Christmas time, we came in the back of trucks. We came in snowmobiles, snow cats, sleds, both covered and uncovered, and snowmobiles, the snowmobiles that they have now. One Christmas, we were leaving the village, and the only accident that I ever remember, unfortunately nobody was ever hurt, but we were going down, and those of you that are drivers know that there is one very sharp switchback, going down the switchbacks, and we had a young man, Dave
Stimson.
Yes, we had more fun with that kid when he was here, he felt so bad. We were going down, and we were in the uncovered sled at that time. And when you went down in the uncovered sled, you had probably 40 or 50 wool blankets covering people up in the back, because the powder, snow powder, would blow up, and you would just keep a little peephole out, you know, to sort of see if the sky was up there and that type of thing. And we were going around that corner, and the sled was not that stable, and it tipped over, and we all just sort of rolled out onto the snowbank. And of course, he got out really in a panic because he was concerned somebody was injured, but nobody was. It was sort of a fun thing, and we just sort of brushed off the snow and walked on down to the dock. And other than that accident and what I still call a relatively minor accident of 2 or 3 years ago, those are the only two vehicle accidents I think that we've had at Holden in the 25 plus years. Some of the other highlights, this is a selfish one with me, and you'll know why when I get done. In September of 1969, well, I guess prior to that, in July of 1969, Carol Hinderly asked me to come up to his office just as we were getting ready to get on the bus to leave that summer after the board meeting, and he wanted me to talk with Fern Olson and Carol to resolve whether or not we were going to put any carpeting in the village. These seem like simple little discussions, but I long ago found out that things like carpeting and the colors you're going to paint walls and things like that, as you talk to your wives and women, they become fairly tacky problems. And Carol was a chicken. He wanted me to address Fern rather than to do it himself. I called him a politician at that time. And so Carol and I were talking with Fern, and Fern was not that desirous of having carpeting in the village, and so finally she conceded that, okay, why don't we go ahead and try it? And the first place that we put carpeting was in Koinonia, both here on this floor and up on the balcony. It was red carpeting, not this carpeting. This is the second carpeting, I think it was put down in 82, I think. And so I ordered the carpeting, and my partner and I came up on September the 7th of that year, brought along a carpet installer, and while he was installing the carpet, my partner and I went fishing. And we had always, by that time, I had backpacked into Holden about four or five years. I did that for 12 years in a row with my family, with our children, and we would take other people along with us. We'd make about a 12 or 14 day hike out of it. And as we came across Cloudy Pass and came down overlooking the valley, there are many lakes, little miniature lakes and potholes and whatnot. And I would spot these, and I one by one decided that I would fish them to see what was there. And I won't tell you which one it was. Rudy would like to know, I know, and some of you others. I have pictures to substantiate this. We almost brought some of the pictures, and then we thought, no, that's a boring thing to have here and just snap pictures for people to look at. They mean something to you, but maybe not as much to others. But my partner and I went to this particular fishing hole, and we just couldn't believe what happened to us. We had to thrash through a lot of brush to get there. We first fished Hart Lake, and we filed off our hooks because we didn't want to necessarily keep the fish that we got out of Hart Lake. We were in anticipation of bigger and better game. And we went to this hole after lunch that day, and as we walked up to the hole, I was leading through the thicket, and my partner was about a minute and a half behind me. And when I got to the edge of this hole, I had my pole already, and I just cast it across this pond, and I started to reel it in as my partner was coming up behind me. And just like that, as it was just as clear as a bell in this pool, and as my line was coming up towards me with a weighted spinning fly on it, here came this trout. It just came up, just like that. And I pulled that in, and that was a 25-inch trout. And we fished that hole for 2.5 hours, and we threw about 25 or 30 fish back in, but we caught another 22 and 23-inch trout, and a 19-inch trout, and 2 18-inch trout. And then we had several smaller ones, and we had to limit ourselves by the weight rather than the size of the trout. So that was a great experience for us. And I will not tell you where it was.
However, he should tell you that he has gone back to the same hole and there has been no fish in it. So.
I took our son back there 3 or 4 years later, and he really thinks he's a fisherman, and he was really looking forward to that. But we did fish that hole for about 45 minutes and we did not get a strike. I would anticipate from the location of it and the type of hole that it is that it is probably fished out by some type of wildlife occasionally, and maybe it gets restocked naturally every 6th, 7th, or 8th year. I'll have to go back by myself once again sometime. Let's talk about the mine monument, which was a great adventure of ours at Holden Village. When I say ours, I mean of Holden Village. The mine monument does not particularly stir up a great emotion in a lot of you, but it was very important to us back in the late 60s and during the 70s. The valley, as we know it here, Railroad Creek Valley, has never been surveyed. So when Mr. Holden filed his claims back at the turn of the century, the Forest Service had to get some type of a reference point in order to mark his claims and any subsequent claims. And in February the 6th of 1902, the Forest Service contracted with a civil engineer over in Spokane who came up here by himself, snowshoed and skied up this valley in February, and went up on the side of this mountain, this valley, and he put a mark, a little cross with 4-inch long lines that crossed each other. And that was the starting point for marking any of Mr. Holden's claims and any subsequent claims in this valley. Obviously the mining people that came subsequent to Mr. Holden, and there were many of them, they knew where that mark was, and whenever they filed a claim, that was their reference point. The Howe Sound Mine Company used it. They filed several claims. The last claim, I think, was about 1943, Rudy, am I correct? Somewhere about that date. And they obviously knew where the X was on that rock. They filed no additional claims. The mining company left, and we lost the mark. And it became paramount to us in those days because maybe in a very nice way, but still in a fairly blunt way, we were often told by the Forest Service that we had to confront the problems that were our legacy, such as Meshack, and who else was out here? The tailings. And at that time, nobody knew whose property those tailings were on, but the Forest Service took the position that they were on Holden property, and therefore they were our responsibility to clean up. And as we began to survey the problem, it wasn't too difficult to come up with 4 or 5 year time period and several millions of dollars to solve that problem that was out there in those tailings. Yet the Forest Service would never quite come to putting a deadline on cleaning them up because we really couldn't establish whose they were. And about that time, several of us started to look for this mine monument. And if you've ever tried to look for the proverbial needle in a haystack, that was the task at hand. And there was a gentleman that used to come up to this village who's now gone also, by the name of John Nyquist, who had been a draftsman for the railroad industry all of his life, and he retired. And he used to come here nearly every winter. He is the gentleman who laid all of the bricks up around the coffee area of the dining hall. He did that on a yearly basis. He'd do another chunk and then another chunk in the walkway and whatnot. And We were here, of course, at Christmas time, and John and I used to always pull out all the old maps, and we would plot how I was going to scour the side of that mountain the next summer when the snows were gone. And I would take our son, even when he was a little kike, and we would go up there and we'd just wander back and forth, just looking for this X on the rocks. And we tried to get sophisticated about it, and we'd get our compass out, and we had compass readings. I finally ran down the page out of the ledger book of the civil engineer from back in 1902. So I felt, now I know exactly where it's at, because I've got these compass readings. And there were three reference points that focused on this X. And I would focus my compass, and I would do everything conceivable, and I couldn't find this X. And at the same time, over a period of about 9 years, there were probably well over 300 people that were up there looking from one time or another during the year for this reference point. Some of them were professional civil engineers. And finally, one summer, Dick Wiederander, many of you remember from back in Iowa, Dick wanted to go up there with me. He, of course, was quite a photographer, and he was hoping to get different pictures and whatnot, and then with what I knew from my research of it, try to get into some type of a format that we could reduce this and finally find this. Well, Dick and I went up there and scoured around for about 3 hours and found nothing and decided to come back down. And as we were coming down, I was directing Dick where to go through the thicket and whatnot to have the minimum encounter. And just before we got to this one thicket, as I was coming along about 75 feet behind him, I sort of lost my balance and I sort of fell over on my side, left side, and I caught myself with my left hand. And I caught myself by my left hand being placed, all of a sudden I realized, on a strange pile of rotted wood. It was not a natural log. It was a log that had been cut. And I later realized it was a 4x4. And this all happened in a matter of probably 3 or 4 seconds. I yelled to Dick, "Just a minute, Dick, I want to check this out." And I very carefully, visually followed this little pile of rotted wood. And as it went up towards the top of the wood, it ceased to be rotted, and it was a solid piece of a 4x4, about 2.5 feet long. So I very carefully turned it over. I don't know why, I just picked it up and turned it over, and the top of it had the coned wedge shape on the top of it. And on the back side of it, perfectly preserved, was nailed a Prince Albert tobacco can. And I had remembered from years before, my grandfather was involved in a lot of mining up in the Coeur d'Alene. And this was one of the customary things that people would do when they marked lines and whatnot in the mountains. They'd take a Prince Albert tobacco can and they'd put their readings on it, and then they'd stuff it in the can and close it and nail it to a tree or a post. So I very carefully opened it up and took out a piece of paper that was absolutely perfectly preserved, like it had been written just 5 minutes before. And I very excitedly, with Dick, came back down to the village, and with that we were able to determine where that location was. And from that, we were able to determine the ravine which we should be looking in, because we weren't even sure which ravine we were supposed to be looking in. So I went up for the next 2 or 3 days scouring the mountainside and found nothing. And several people after me with those instructions looked for this mark. It wasn't until the next summer that we came up for the board meeting, and our children did not come with us. That was the first year that our son did not come, and he always looked with me, both at Christmas time and in the summer. I went up by myself the morning of the 4th of July parade. I went up about 6:30 in the morning, thought I'd spend a couple hours up there looking around, and lo and behold, I started to scour around some rock faces up there, and I crawled out on a little rock ledge, and the parade was just beginning to assemble down here. So I sat out on the edge of the rock ledge and thought I would just rest, and I had a couple of oranges with me, and I ate those, and I was just about ready to get up to come back down, and as I put my left hand down to raise up off the rock, right down by my left hand, when I looked down to see where it was at, was a strange mark. And I looked at it, and I reached over, and I ran my fingers across it like this, and I said to myself, I'll be darned, that's the mark I've been looking for. And it had obviously weathered a lot, but that was the mark. And so from that I took my compass and
his wife.
Tape measure, and I measured out the three reference points to make sure that that was it, and I found the reference points, and came back down. The village was in progress, and Loretta was sitting alongside of Gertrude Lundholm when I came down, and I didn't even stop to talk to anybody. I just went running through the village because I was going to get an axe, and I was going to go up and blaze it. I was going to get some marking tape and do all these kind of things, and so Loretta happened to see. She saw me, and I looked excited, so she said, did you find it? And I said, yes, I did. And she said, you're kidding. And I said, no. And I said, do you want to go with me? So she really volunteered. And she went up with me, and we tramped through the brush, and we marked
it. For those of you who've been up there, tramping through the down the Alder is wonderful.
I might tell you one of the complications of finding this. It's a real quirk that happened. And nobody knew of this at the time to say this to us, but approximately in 1930-31, the U.S. Geological and Survey team came through this part of the North Cascades, resurveying the area, and that's when there were a lot of benchmarks that were put out in the early and mid 30s around the area, and unbeknownst to us, there are two mountains up that valley. One is called North Star, and the other is called Bonanza. And the U.S. Geological and Survey team inadvertently, when they redrew the maps in the mid-1930s, turned them around. Bonanza was North Star, and North Star was Bonanza. And when the civil engineer came through in 1902 and laid that mark up there, he had them correct. But the maps as we know them today, they're turned around. And that's why we could never get a bearing on that mark. Mm. It seems so simple that you should be able to find it. But when somebody turns mountains around on you, it's very, very difficult. Loretta, I know you're just bursting with things that you want to say to these people.
Well, the significance of finding this, of course, was then that when the Forest Service sent a team in to survey, they found that the tailings were not on Holden land, they are on Forest Service land. So that was a big relief to the village, I think.
Yes. And then...
The year that you found this, the 4th of July, what year?
1979?
No, I think a little bit before.
78?
I've got the date up
through. All right, 78 or somewhere along. It might have been 78, somewhere along there. Something like that.
Yeah, because I think Warner, it was just a couple of years before Warner left that the Forest Service actually sent a team in to officially survey it.
Once they surveyed it, the only tailings that are on our property are the corners of this first tailing pile, right in back of us here. There's a small part of the corner of that tailing pile that's on the forest, on the Holden Village property, that is our patented mining claims. The rest of it is all on Forest Service property. And I think there's probably been a significant cooling of the effort to reforest and whatnot those tailings. At least there's been no great push. Although I have to say in support of the Forest Service that they tried for several years, for 3 years running, to get the funds budgeted in order to contour those tailings into the side of the mountain and reforest them. And the village offered the volunteer labor and staff to help them do that. Loretta, do you have anything else you want to say?
No, I guess the only thing I want to say is how we started bringing the cookies up. That second winter we were up here, we had the kitchen finished in here, which was right behind those double doors there. It was just a very small kitchen with a small stove, and we didn't have a dishwasher or anything like that in there. And so we would decide to cook a meal, and all the guests were cooks. You know, nobody was designated as any particular person. And we started cooking Christmas dinner, and then, and still, for those of you who have been here in the winter, not as often anymore, but if a hunk of slush or ice comes through the generator, it shuts the power off. And so somebody has to go up and clean it out to get it started again. Well, we just got our turkey and our pies and things in the oven, and the power went off and was off for 3.5 hours. So, you know, that was wonderful on turkey and everything. So then I decided the next year that, well, why not bake at home and just take it up and then not have to worry about baking. And also baking cookies in that kind of oven for you women that bake doesn't work very well, because you have heat part of the time. Part of the time you have really hot heat because electricity comes in surges. And other times you don't have enough, so it gets very cold. And that's what started the baking then. And this last year was the first winter I was not able to do it because of ill health, and it I still feel guilty about it. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. Oh, we did it. So.
And that reminds me of one of the things I had almost forgotten about was that whole business of the power going on. Mm-hmm. And everybody that was up here during the time when that happened frequently, was that there was an almost automatic response. As soon as the lights began to flicker or dim, you just jumped for a flashlight or something.
Yes, yes.
And I remember one time being back in Los Angeles, and I was eating dinner at a hotel restaurant, and it was right between, you know, that time when they switched the menus and switched the prices and everything, mm-hmm. and they dimmed the lights. And, you know, they dimmed the lights, and I automatically
As you never went anywhere up here in the early years in the winter unless you had a flashlight with you, because you could be anywhere. You could be in the shower and the lights would go off and the power would go off, and it might be off for 10 minutes because they'd have to still get from here up there, or it might be off for an hour or 2 hours or whatever. And so consequently the heat was, you know, real erratic too, because we didn't have a wood stove in the building or anything. And so you really came prepared to either cook or freeze or one or the other. But the guests in those early years always were part of the staff. You made your own beds, you did your own laundry, when the day you were leaving, you made sure your beds were changed, and you tried to help out with everything.
You cooked, you were on the cooking staff.
The dish team.
Dish teams. I know my partner, when he came up several years, he was a baker before he became a CBA, and he would always bake pastry, get up at 4 o'clock every morning, just love it, bake pastry. It was that type of lefse. We've got experiences of lefse up in the kitchen. Mark Upgrand. Some of you remember Mark. We have a picture of Mark taking his first stick of uncooked lefse to put on the hot surface, and he dropped it on the floor. And those kind of fun things. Everybody got involved in the project. I really have to say that it was like one big happy family get together. It was very, very comfortable. Very comfortable.
July the 4th, 78, Howard.
All right, thank you.
78.
Yeah. We've run over. Are you? Any other questions? We'll be glad to.
One thing Howard didn't mention is that Bertie was Santa Claus when he brought his child, but when we were up here, Howard was Santa Claus. And our son was 4, and he was at that age. Well, maybe there was a Santa Claus and maybe there wasn't, and so he came up and wanted to know about it. And I said, well, what do you think? He said, Well, he sure sounds like Howard Gillick. And so then he had to go right down and share it with Christy, who was only 3 1/2. She said, oh, no way, that was not Howard Gillick. So Mark really never was sure after that whether it was or not.